Thank you all. Please be seated.
This is a time set for oral argument in our case number CACV250509, Bell Bank versus Michael Japp. Each side is allocated 20 minutes for oral argument. Appellant, if you wish to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal, you're free to do so, but you need to keep track of your own time at the podium clock. Out of respect for counsel and to avoid embarrassment, I would ask that everyone ensure that their phones are turned off so our proceedings are not being interrupted. We've read the briefs. We've conferenced the case. We'd encourage you to keep that in mind as you present oral argument today. Our proceedings are being recorded and will be posted to YouTube in due course. So please, as you begin your presentation, tell us your name and the party that you represent. With that, Mr. Giles, you may proceed. Sorry, I was looking at the
good afternoon,
more typical setup.
Yes, we decided to sit on opposite sides today.
There you go.
My name is Philip Giles. I, along with my colleague, Mr. Deutsch, sitting next to me, represent Michael C. Japp, the appellant in this matter. I would like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for purposes of rebuttal. To begin, this appeal calls for the reversal of an order entered by the trial court approving a receiver's motion to sell remnant assets. The receiver was appointed under Title 12, and his last action in the case was to sell these remnant assets and close out the receivership. We believe the trial court erred in entering that order for three specific reasons. First, the receiver's authority is grounded in the collateral of the lender that put the receiver in place, and that collateral is specifically defined in the loan documents. The receiver attempted to sell or did sell these certain tort claims against my client and others and couched them as part of the collateral. However, it's clear from not only the express words in the collateral description, which would have been included in the UCC financing statement and loan documents, that such commercial tort claims were not included.
And there was no objection to the sale of the other claims involving the accountant?
There was no objection made on behalf of the accountant, but that sale really involved four buckets of assets. One was AR claims, another was insurance proceeds due to the company, third was an inventory issue related with another vendor, and then the fourth bucket was tort claims against my client, the former CFO of the business, as well as the accountant. So our limited objection, I represent Michael C. Japp. I filed the objection on behalf of Michael C. Japp, but our position is the sale could not have included the tort claims at all. So bucket four, so to speak, should never have been part of the sale.
Counsel, let me ask you, and I know you've just framed out issue one of three that you want to address.
Yes.
You're not arguing, are you, that under the receivership statute, that the ability to transfer these claims was improper? Are you arguing that under the order, the court's order, it was improper?
I would argue it's improper under the statute too, because the
tell me how under 1241, which is about as broad a statute as I could imagine, how this and also then tell me where you argued that in Superior Court.
Sure. So our objection did not necessarily go to our limited objection did not necessarily go to the specifics as to Title 12, Section 1241, not allowing the sale.
Right.
But if you look at that statute, you're right. It's as broad as possible. The problem is, in order to interpret what that means, there's a dearth of case law out there. But what we do know from Rule 66, which is the rule utilized to put a receivership into place, is that under Rule 66C, the receiver has so many powers. And nothing in there gives the receiver the power to sell or assign litigation claims. The receiver can absolutely commence and defend legal actions. That's the exact verbiage of Rule 66. But nothing in there gives him the ability to sell and assign. And that's a fundamental problem that I think this case is dealing with, which
is... Let me ask you a couple questions on that. Can a rule narrow a statute?
I would argue it could, as broad as that, because that's the process defining certain Rule 66 is the process to obtain a receiver and defining certain powers the receiver has. And what we have under the Arizona revised statutes is a clear example of you have Title 12 that's very broad, But then you have a Title 33 receivership, and that's the Uniform Commercial Real Estate Receivership Act, that narrows rules and abilities from the receiver from there.
And I, the other question then is, where would I find your objection under 66C as opposed to the collateral and order objection to the Superior Court? I don't remember that.
The Rule 66 argument is not in the limited objection. But I think here, despite how broad the statute is, you have an appointment order with very specific delegated authorities.
And I want to get back to that order real quick.
Sure.
But isn't that a waiver if it wasn't presented to the trial court?
I would disagree, Your Honor, because I think the appointment order narrowed what authority this receiver
and,
had
and again,
in this case.
I get the order issue, and I want us to get there, but
yep.
I'm talking now about the statute and the rule. And I just didn't see objections based on those two. I saw objections based on the order and the definition of collateral, the issues you're just getting into before
sure.
I interrupted you.
Yep.
But I'm not seeing a statutory objection. I'm not seeing a rule objection in the record.
Well, what you do see is objections based off of the authority of the receivership as determined by the appointment order. That's what you have. But you're correct.
Okay.
There is no citation to Rule 66C specifically.
Could I ask you, when you suggest that it is okay for the receiver to file a lawsuit and obtain a liquidated damage against someone else, You agree that that's within the scope of authority of a receiver under the statute?
I agree the scope of the authority under the statute is very broad, so I think it should be within there. We know from Rule 66C it's within there.
And you're just suggesting, though, that it's improper to sell that type of claim. It's okay to pursue it on your own but not sell it.
Correct, because what I would say is let's look at what a receiver is. It's a third-party neutral fiduciary put in place to protect property of certain parties, to an extent maintain the status quo, and take certain actions to usually resolve a distressed situation.
But if you can file a lawsuit, let's say there was someone who broke into to a business, damaged some property, there's a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
Is it measurably different to say, I'm going to bring a lawsuit and pursue it to completion, and maybe just decide I'm going to settle that for a $10,000, I'm just going to get a $10,000 settlement and move on because we don't have the time or resources to litigate it. How is that different than saying I'm going to sell that claim to someone else to pursue for $10,000?
Because the receiver is the party empowered to sell that claim, and the receiver should have gone back to the court to ask if he could have the authority to sell claims. And that's part of what's in the appointment order, which is you have paragraph 28. Now, I will say there's a note I want to make on 28, but paragraph 28 says the receiver or Bell Bank, which was the lender that put the receiver in place, can go back to the court, file an application, provide notice to get either clear instruction on the receivership order or potentially expand its scope.
But didn't that essentially happen? I mean, I realize you didn't go and ask permission, but the same court signs off on the receiver's request to do this.
I would agree not, because if we take the position it essentially happened, what we also have to concede is that the receiver doesn't follow his own order appointing him. And I think that's required. Plus, remember, the receiver is the third-party neutral. It was Bell Bank that wanted the receiver in place. It's my client and my client's company that stipulated to the receiver. We are the parties to the action, not really the receiver. I think it's somewhat inappropriate for a receiver to constantly go back to court and expand his authority without party involvement.
I thought you just said that's what a receiver can do.
The receiver can do what the powers are allocated.
But
to
go back to the court and seek instruction.
That's in paragraph 28. So I concede that paragraph 28 of the order allowed the receiver to do it here. I'm just explaining to the court, I think it really should be the parties who do that. But that language is in the order, and the receiver did not follow that protocol.
But what are we to make of the fact that the same court, the same individual who issued the order appointing the receiver, then issued the order appointing the sale or approving the sale, finding that that was consistent with and within the receiver's order?
I think what we have to make of it is the trial court got it wrong. I mean, if you look at the trial court's decision, it begins, in my view, the one sentence of analysis starts with the first clause. The receiver is empowered to bring and prosecute certain causes of action. And that's true. You can find that in the appointment order. There's nothing in there that says the receiver in the appointment order can sell and assign the cause of action.
Well,
the next clause.
It says more than that, but go ahead.
Well, there's two clauses, really, right? It's bring and prosecute action and then management of the business.
Bring and prosecute actions with related to the collateral as well as manage the business. Exactly.
Well, and the related to the collateral gets into the UCC arguments.
No, I understand.
Sure.
But then, accordingly, the court concludes that proposed sale is appropriate. That's the same order, the same judge, the very same person, not no rotation, nothing like that,
sure.
who issued the receiver order.
I just think it's incorrect because what that did was cause a unilateral modification of the authorities that the receiver had under that order without going through the process.
Could the receiver have just filed a motion and said, I've been appointed to manage the affairs of the business? In my view, managing the affairs of the business dictates that I should pursue some valid claims against an accountant, against somebody who broke into the building or whatever. Do I have permission to do that?
I think that would be the application with notice that's required under Rule 28. And then we would have an opportunity to respond to that as both the business owner and the business itself. And the court would then have to make a ruling about
whether...
And
you're saying there was no opportunity to respond.
That application was never filed. But wait a minute.
Right? Yeah, there was a motion for court approval that you had notice of and you filed your limited objection to.
Right, but so I thought the question was, isn't there an opportunity for the receiver to file with the court a motion saying there are these claims and I would like to be able to pursue them? And I view that as the application and notice to expand the powers of the receiver under the appointment order, and that's the procedure in paragraph 28. That didn't happen here. What the receiver did was assume he had the powers and file the motion to sell the remnant assets.
But once there was an objection to that, isn't the receiver essentially saying, I would like the power to do this? And then the court is saying yes.
I have trouble getting there because I think it's somewhat putting the cart before the horse. I don't think the receiver should be filing the motion for relief he doesn't necessarily have to seek approval before actually going to the court to determine if he has that relief to begin with or if the order should be expanded to grant him that type
of
relief.
But doesn't all that turn on two things that I think did happen, court approval and notice to all involved? I mean, that happened here. It may not have happened, and again, it didn't happen in the way you're submitting it should have.
Sure.
But this was not a sort of cover of darkness kind of thing. You had notice, and in fact, your client objected.
Did have notice, but then I have, I think there's trouble reconciling the end result of the decision, which is nothing in the order gave the receiver the ability to sell and assign claims, meaning delegating his duties under the order.
If the answer is manage the business, wouldn't include those sorts of
Well, powers. I think that's an evidentiary issue, and that's one of the issues in this case. Which
why would that be an evidentiary issue if it's the question of what the court's order authorized? And the court that issued that order said, yes, this was authorized.
Because the court authorized the receiver to conduct the business, to manage the business of DeRealTech, which is the underlying company. But there's no actual evidence taken as to what that entails. And the sale of litigation claims by a business against its business owner is certainly not an ordinary course transaction.
100%, I agree.
And so you can't just rest on managing the business, particularly when elsewhere in the order there are provisions that keep the business executives in place and continuing to work with the receiver.
But don't businesses almost every day take out of the ordinary course action?
Maybe. I can't speak for businesses on their everyday actions. I'm sure it does happen. But that doesn't mean we get to use that and just look past all the issues that arose in this case, which is there's no evidence taken as to what the ordinary course business of DeRealTech was.
What we're suggesting is if something happens that's out of the ordinary course, what we're suggesting is that you can't do something out of the ordinary course without getting permission from the court. But here there was permission from the court.
Well,
what are we missing?
There's two issues there. First, the receiver had no authority to sell any asset that was not collateral. That's clear from paragraph 6 of the appointment order. You can see that the power to sell is tethered to the phrase the collateral.
You're saying he could have pursued a lawsuit against someone.
Correct. So he didn't have the power to sell the legal claims, because the only power to sell is tethered to the collateral, and for all the UCC arguments we made.
So if he had just gone to the accountant and said, we will settle our claim against you for $50,000, that would be okay?
Correct. That would absolutely be okay.
But not okay to say, he's not settling, it's going to cost a fortune to litigate it. I've got someone here who's willing to pursue a claim. We would have been willing to settle for $50,000. He's not willing to settle. Will you pay us $50,000 to to buy this claim.
See, I would say that's the type of factual basis that should be in the application submitted under paragraph 28 of the appointment order to obtain that relief. But that did not happen here. I mean, I can speak on account of my client, not necessarily the accountant, but we're unaware of any demands from the receiver or discussion of these litigation claims. The motion to sell these claims was just filed, the motion to sell remnant assets was filed and a surprise to all. But to your point, Judge Catani, I agree with all that, which is he could have gone, and if it was settlement, it was unlikely, and it didn't make sense to pursue that litigation, gone back to the court, filed an application under paragraph 28 of the appointment order, and sought expanded relief,
And the court could have granted that?
Could have, depending on if there were objections and what the court ultimately decided.
Okay, and so what is, and I understand that the process was not followed as set forth in the order, but if you concede that the result is a permissible result and you had the notice and you had an opportunity to be heard, what is missing? What is truly missing? Other than following the page in line of the process to get permission to make that sale.
Well, but if the page in line of the paper, or here the appointment order, is what governs the receiver's authority, I think the receiver has to follow that in order to even get to a point of expanding the authority. Otherwise, is the page in line worthless at that point?
But if we're to vacate and remand, mm-hmm. why would we expect anything other than what happened? Since there was no, people were on notice, the court approved. It didn't happen in the dark of night. So if it goes back, why would there be any chance of a different result?
Well, because if the ruling is really couched in the management authority of DeRealTech, the court's going to have to take evidence as to what that actually entails and whether management or the manager was a party who could even sell or sign a legal claim. I mean, I don't mean to go on too much of a tangent, but just think of it this way and then somewhat of an analogy. Take any retail store you can imagine. They're, of course, going to have a floor manager, then a general manager, then a district manager, and so on. None of them can file a lawsuit on behalf of the company. The court needs to take evidence on what this means, especially when we're talking about a manufacturing and tolling company dealing in the secondary scrap market.
Doesn't the receiver essentially take the place of whoever has authority to act on behalf of the company?
Not necessarily. I would say the receivership's authority is dictated by the order, and that's kind of the crux here, right? Which is if the statute Title 12
say manage the business, that's the authority for someone in charge of the business is to manage the business.
The other managers remained in place, so we had a manufacturing site manager. I can't remember his last name Eric, still working during this time. I mean, that's the problem. We don't know the extent of the receiver's authority, and it was never necessarily agreed upon by my client that the authority would be end all as to the company. And remember,
you've taken the position, I think, in response to our questions,
sure.
that the receiver could have sued. That's a management function, right? Could have pressed these claims as opposed to selling them. So again, I'm struggling with why that's a distinction with a difference given the orders that come to us.
Well, because remember the preamble, the appointment order is the receivers put in place with respect to the collateral, and the collateral specifically defined, and the claims alleged relate to the collateral. The receiver has made clear these litigation claims against my client are from the collateral.
I guess I was focusing, just so we're on the same page, on the management. And I thought I heard you say in response to Judge Catani's question that the receiver could bring these claims as managing the company. It's just the assignment that was the problem. Maybe I misheard you.
No, I did say that, but the issue with the claims stated is they all relate to the collateral. So I don't even think the management authority necessarily helps here because the receiver is already charged with maintaining, protecting, and preserving the collateral and taking actions on account of
that. So just to be clear.
Yep.
Could the receiver have brought these claims as opposed to selling them under the receivership order?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Can I ask just another question? Was
I noticed was there, I'm nearly out of time, so I hope to answer that question for you.
Sure. Was the receiver winding up the affairs of the company, or was it anticipated that it was going to continue as an ongoing concern?
It began with an interest in trying to have it as an ongoing concern, and then it turned into a liquidation where effectively the assets were sold to a competitor.
Well, and does that change your analysis at all of what the receiver would be doing? Why hang on to the receivers have going to have to stay in place for how many years to litigate, as opposed to, I think this is too time consuming and expensive. I'd rather just sell it to another company.
It doesn't, because I still have trouble with the fact that you have a court-appointed fiduciary to take certain actions, and the sale of the litigation claims that you could bring is a delegation of those duties for a profit, and I don't think that's appropriate or was anticipated when establishing receivership statute. So I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. We'll add 2 minutes on each side to give you a little bit more full opportunity for rebuttal. Mr. Winkleman.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'd like to start with probably the easiest way to affirm the trial court, which is identified, I think, in the second point that the court identified in the oral argument notice, which is the trial court's ability to amend or modify its orders. And in Zimmerman v. Shackman, 204 Arizona 231, a trial court can modify or amend any of its prior orders until those orders become final. There's an argument that the order appointing a receiver is final under ARS 12-2101A, don't quote me on that, which does allow it to be appealable. But in this case, the finality and it being appealable does have some distinction. And the reason for that is Rule 66, as interpreted in Hyatt v. Shaw, specifies that principles of equity govern all matters relating to the appointment of receivers, their powers, duties and liabilities, and the court's power. So we're starting from the fact that this appointment is an equitable proceeding. And in Hyatt v. Shaw, that's identified as having, you know, the trial court has broad authority to control claims brought against a receivership estate, and the principles of equity govern whenever applicable. And fashioning equitable remedies are precisely within the court's discretion. And absent an abuse of discretion, whatever remedy is fashioned should not be overturned on appeal. And this is all from Hyatt v. Shaw.
So if the receiver had not asked for permission to sell the tort claims, would you view that as being problematic under the appointment order?
I think it would likely be a problem if they hadn't gone to court and asked for it. And the reason is paragraph 6 of the receivership order did indicate that all proposed non-ordinary course transactions have to be presented to the court for approval. And so I think the receiver needed to go get court approval for this. And by doing so, effectively requested from the court approval to proceed with the sale, both under the sale order, but also as a form of equitable remedy to wrap up the receivership estate for the benefit of its creditors.
I mean, what's your response to the argument that it's okay, presumably the receiver would have to seek permission from the court just to pursue tort claims on its own that don't seem to be in the ordinary course of business. If that's conceded that you have to get permission to do that, but is it something different to sell that claim to a third party? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I did want to clarify. I'm not sure the receivership order requires approval from the court to bring actions. I think paragraph 5AA empowers the receiver to bring such legal actions, and it does not appear to be, you know, clarified that it has to go back and request. But there's no reason in the receivership statute, Rule 66, or this order, that the receiver has some special duty to litigate claims. Obviously, I understand that they're a quasi-judicial officer in that capacity, but there's no significant reason the receiver would be better positioned to liquidate those claims for the benefit of creditors than selling those claims to another to prosecute in that capacity. And there's
Is there a difference if the receiver were to pursue the claims, and let's say against a complete third party, and obtain a settlement of $50 million, the receiver would have the money on behalf of the estate as opposed to a third party. I'm curious if there are excess proceeds from a lawsuit. Does that change the analysis at all?
I don't think so. And I would say that the best reason why not is that receivers liquidate assets all the time. And we don't go back and second guess later if the person they sell it to puts time and energy and additional capital and then turns it into a much better deal. And if we did, receivers would have a much harder time selling receivership property. Typically, things sold out of receivership are not sold in a normal commercial course. They are usually sold at a lower price than what you'd normally expect because they're distressed. And so by requiring the receiver to go beyond normal business judgment on the valuation of those assets and to go further and say, you know, if we sell this and then it turns out that we sold it too low, we're liable, that would sort of undercut the receiver's ability to liquidate estates, I think.
So you don't see any difference between just I'm selling a tractor as opposed to a tort claim. Either way, it's an asset of the company.
Yes, I think that's correct. It is an asset of the company. It's a claim held by the company for harm it had. Obviously, it's a different type of asset, but claims are definitely a type of asset. And I would argue that other than of their type, there's no significant distinction between a claim and a tractor. The other component to that is the price was disclosed to all parties, and there were no challenges to the sale of these assets on the basis of their price. All of the creditors had a chance to come in and say, you know, we don't think this is an appropriate sale price. The argument was only that the folks that would be sued as a result of the sale didn't want those claims to be transferred. But there was never any objection that, you know, you're selling this tractor too cheap. We're worried as creditors that we're not going to get enough out of this. And so I think that
supposes, though, in this case, you would require Mr. Jeff to say, no, you've got a very valuable claim against me. That
sure. But none of the other creditors.
Awkward.
Correct. In addition to Rule 66 and the interpretation in Hyatt, Section 5CC also made it clear that the court was intending this to be a broad order to give the receiver ability to pivot on an equitable basis. And, you know, it says it's to generally do such other things as may be necessary or incidental to the foregoing specific powers, including the specific powers to bring suits. The sale of those suits to liquidate them could be an incidental power under this, and it turns out that's what the court must have thought. But further, at the end of 5CC, it specifically indicates the court further orders that in addition to the powers set forth specifically herein, the receiver will have and enjoy the powers otherwise provided by law, which we know from Rule 66 and the receivership statute are broad equitable powers. So, again,
Rule 66 does not mention the sale of tort claims, though, does it?
No, it doesn't. And that would definitely be a form of equitable remedy fashioned by the receiver, proposed to the court, and then approved by the court in this case. And I don't think there's any argument that the court can't approve the sale of assets out of a receivership as a sort of equitable remedy. Obviously, there could be litigation about it, and indeed we have it here, but the question is, did the court abuse its discretion by selling an asset for value for the benefit of DeRealtek's creditors? And the only real argument is, well, the receivership didn't have those. And so turning to the proceeds argument, there are out-of-state cases suggesting that there is a significant difference between a tort claim, the settlement, you know, the funds received as a result of that tort claim, and proceeds. This can be resolved by Arizona's UCC itself. ARS Section 4791.02.64 C and D specifically state that claims are a form of proceeds. In the Wiersma case, the Idaho bankruptcy case, Idaho's UCC does not specifically identify proceeds as a portion of it. The Massachusetts statute, which was relevant in American Carthage, does mention tort claims. And I would simply submit that while they may be persuasive authority, if we simply look at what the statutes and the collateral agreements say, what is intended by the drafters of the UCC is this. We have commercial tort claims, which are not proceeds, and we have commercial tort claims, which are proceeds. And the Venn diagram has some overlap. We've got proceeds, commercial tort claims, and some that are both. And if a collateral agreement specifically identifies claims related to the destruction or interference with that collateral as proceeds, we have to somehow argue that without specific statutory language, the drafters of the UCC did not want commercial tort claims related to the specific destruction of collateral to be included in the definition of proceeds.
If we're talking about collateral, though, what about any monies that were taken long before the collateral agreement with the bank? Let's say something happened 10 years earlier that's still a possible tort claim. How does that fit within is that collateral?
I would argue no, because by definition of the collateral agreement, the proceeds arise, and if you...
And I kind of understood the receiver to be saying everything is collateral. It didn't really delineate when the alleged wrongdoing had occurred.
So the alleged wrongdoing is between 2018 and 2023, and the collateral agreement arose in 21. And so to the extent that these tort claims were solely collateral, then those claims would be limited from 21 to 23. If these were claims that DeRealTech possessed as assets over and above that were then liquidated as part of the wind down, then they would span the entire period subject to statutes of limitation defense. But the proceeds portion of it is simply from 21 to 23.
You're saying to affirm, we would have to conclude that the receiver obtained permission to do something in the course of business, got authorization after notice to the other side, and sold an asset that was then available to pay creditors.
That's one way the court could affirm. I think there are two distinct avenues. One, the court could say that some portion of these claims were proceeds and that those were the claims that were transferred. The court could also say that these were simply assets of DeRealTech that were sold as part of the day-to-day business, which became liquidating all of its assets, in which case it would be a different basis for affirming. And so if it's proceeds, it's one thing. If it's managing the day-to-day business, it's a separate thing. But I think those are two distinct routes to affirm the trial court.
But aren't they distinct routes to slightly different destinations?
Yes.
Given the timeline that you're talking about, if collateral is the collateral and proceeds, it's not a complete affirm.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, I think it would still be a complete affirm. It would just change the nature of what was sold, because the receiver didn't, you know, say, I'm selling you tort claims from this year to this year. They
right.
said, we believe, you know, because these are remnant assets, the amount of diligence is minimal. We believe we have some claims against this owner. Here's our evidence. It appears between 2018 and 2023 there were improper distributions. I think if this court affirmed and specified that it was limited solely to the collateral, you know, that would be in the ongoing state court suit an argument as to what the scope or what the relevant years are. But I don't think it's necessarily a reversal in part of the trial court's order, because the trial court wasn't...
You're selling that whatever it is, basically.
Correct.
A quick claim, sort of.
Yes. If there is something, you can have it, and you can have whatever we have, which if this court determines it was solely proceeds, it would be limited to the period from the establishment of the security agreement until...
2021 on.
Yeah.
And is that consistent with the underlying transaction documents that sold the claims?
I don't recall exactly what language was used in those sale documents. My memory, which is admittedly poor at times, is that the court that the underlying sale agreement specifically identified tort claims related to fraudulent transfers as to Michael Japp. But if there's more granularity, then yeah, I will.
And is that a question for us to answer, or is that a question to be answered in the ongoing litigation as to what the scope of?
I think that that's something to be dealt with in the ongoing litigation. That's a pretty factually dependent issue. That would be beyond the scope of even the factual record in the receivership order, since that was never raised or litigated, essentially.
I understand that answer, but when I ask about the two different paths to the slightly different destination, I think if collateral and proceeds from collateral is limited in time, this court would be asked, if that's the path, this court would be asked to answer that question. Now, it's not all clear to me that we have the right parties in the room to make that sort of call, but.
My client sort of bought what he bought, and what he has is determined based on whatever claims can be asserted against Michael Japp that were held by DeRealTech related to these transfers.
But he seems to have claims that relate to conduct that occurred prior to any collateral being obtained by the bank. Should we remand it to say that order should be changed to limit it to collateral that was offered?
Well, I think that depends on this court's ruling. If this court rules that the only way this sale could have occurred was if these claims were the collateral of Bell Bank, then this court has to limit the scope of the claims from 21 to 23. And I'm not going to argue otherwise. I think clearly if the only reason that these were part of the receivership estate was that they were proceeds of the collateral, I'm not even going to fight that it would be a limited scope. Mr. Giles and I have discussed it. You know, that's part of what we bought. It may be if it's just the collateral, it's 21 on. If these were assets of DeRealTech that were proceeds of the bank's collateral, but were also separately assignable under the authority vested in the receiver and approved by the court, then it would be the broader period. And so if the court were to determine that the court could not if this court were to determine that the trial court could not freely assign the assets of DeRealTech under this order or under equitable powers, but could assign the collateral of Bell Bank, then I think it would be a natural result that the collateral would be limited from 21 to 23. And I'm not sure that there's a need for a remand on that. I think this court is well-versed to say it's just the collateral, so MC claims assets are limited to whatever that collateral is, which we know began in 21. If instead the receiver had broader powers than just related to the collateral, then the larger number of years would be in place. If the court has no further questions, those are the points I wanted to make today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just want to make a couple of points real quick. First, I know Mr. Winkleman was focusing on state law and the definition of claims. Here in Arizona, we do have a separate definition for commercial tort claims, and so it should not be lumped in to claims as used elsewhere in the Uniform Commercial Code, where commercial tort claims are defined as Title 47, 91023A. Second, if we're talking about the timeline and the two paths that Judge Stima, you brought up, remember, part of our argument is the release that was granted by Bell Bank. That release was granted to my client and the other guarantors prior to the sale agreement being entered into or the sale motion having been filed. So if these litigation claims are premised on the collateral, which again, from our UCC argument, we don't think it falls within the collateral, but if they're premised on it, that is a broad and unequivocal release. These claims should not move forward against my client regardless of the timeline because of that release.
That was the release from the bank, though, right?
Correct.
DeRealTech has never released claims.
But the receiver was put in place on account of the collateral. And if we are saying that the litigation claims relate to or arise from the collateral, he's holding the claims that the bank otherwise would have, but there was no exclusive control over those claims, and the bank settled them with my client.
Wouldn't that be an issue more properly before, I'll call it the next court, the next case, if those claims are pressed?
I'm not sure, because I think this issue touches on what's in the receivership estate, and if you recall from the appointment order, collateral and receivership estate carry the exact same definition. So I actually do think it's relevant to this proceeding, though it could very well be relevant to the next proceeding.
Got it.
The last thing is, I know there's been discussions of equity. Under Rule 66D, it talks about if applicable equitable principles can apply. The case out of Division II recently, NBD Enters LLC versus Arnold, 579 P3rd 874. That decision touches on equity as well. But where it focuses on it, it says equitable principles can be a guide, not necessarily the total answer or solution here. And you got to remember, equity cuts both ways. My client agreed to the terms in that appointment order. My client's company, through separate counsel, agreed to the terms in that appointment order. If we're going to bring equitable principles into consideration, my client should have had an opportunity to oppose a modification had it been brought pursuant to paragraph 28 of the appointment order. And that did not happen. So without that, unless there's further questions, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your briefing. We appreciate your argument today. We'll take the matter under advisement. We'll issue a written ruling in due course. Court's in recess.